Well, thank you, and good morning, everyone. Carl, listening to your introduction there, I found it a little bit alarming, really, because I was also born in 1960, which makes me a boomer. And more alarmingly, it must mean I'm rapidly approaching 60 as well. To the topic at hand, now I was being interviewed earlier this year, and one of the questions I was asked is, well, can you give us a one-word summary that kind of captures everything that went on in 2019? Now, to be honest, I thought this is a ridiculous question. There were so many different moving parts in the story for last year. How can you summarise it down to one word? But then finally occurred to me there is a word out there that picks it all up, and that word is uncertainty. We climbed a wall of worry in 2019, and that certainly had some impacts on economic activity around the world, and it also had a big impact on financial markets as well. And I think it's actually going to be a pretty useful word to keep on hand for 2020 as well. So what worries the world? Well, there have been many concerns, and I've just summarised some of them on this particular chart here. Shows you the sorts of topics that we've been searching for on Google over the last year or so. And some of them are the pretty obvious ones, you know, things like trade wars and Brexit and the like. Some of these concerns have been persistent, some have been short-lived. Some pertain more to financial markets who worried about exotic things like negative yields and inverted yield curves and so on, though. But in the end, I think it all sort of came together into a general concern, uncertainty about the outlook and the risk of recession. And looking back at 2019, I think we actually came pretty close to that recession. The problem that you find is that in uncertain times, a couple of things happen. The first thing that happens is businesses tend to put off their capital spending plans. And what you also see, of course, is households tend to put off their purchases of big-ticket items like motor vehicles and the like. And we can certainly see that in the global economic numbers for last year. So if you look at the chart on the left-hand side here, the red line is actually a measure of global uncertainty. As that red line goes down, what it means is we're becoming more uncertain about the outlook and economic policy and the like. And you can see in tandem with that that spending on consumer durables, the blue line there, that slowed in a range of countries around the world last year. And businesses cut things like their spending on machinery and equipment, the green line there. So you can see how that uncertainty kind of flowed into the economic story. Well, if you move on from that, what you discover is, well, actually, most of what gets made is consumer durables and business investment goods. So not surprisingly, global industrial production, the blue line on that chart on the right-hand side, also headed south. Most global trade is goods that get made for business and consumers. And so not surprisingly, global trade also nosedived over the last year. And clearly, you know, that something impacted all countries, including Australia. So that uncertainty had a very significant impact. But there's another part of this story that's particularly relevant as well. In uncertain times, yes, we cut back our investment spending. But what also happens is, in uncertain times, we lift our savings rates. And that's what, again, has been happening around the world. And the chart here is just looking at the major economies. But you can see in the green line there, the big increase in global savings that was going on. It's actually running ahead of global investment. And this is just straight out economics. So the supply of money, if you like, is running ahead of the demand for that money right now. The price has got to adjust. So this chart is the fundamental reason that interest rates are very low everywhere at the moment, and why they're likely to remain low for an extended period. And so certainly something to factor into business plans. But the risk that comes with this, of course, is that when rates are low, the typical financial market response is to look, where can I find a better rate of return, yield pickup, and where can I actually pursue a chance of capital gain? So the response to these low rates is to take on more risk. It's not just businesses that have been doing this. Households have done it as well. And I think that is a particular area of concern in the outlook for here. So it's not just about putting your money into the bank account, term deposits, whatever. We can see in CBA data, for example, there's been a big increase in people opening up CommSec accounts and things like that. So households have also taken on more risk. It's not just business that have been doing this. So it tells you an environment where we should be prepared for volatility from a financial market perspective. But by the end of last year, the early part of this year, it's fair to say that some of that uncertainty was receding. We had a trade deal, Brexit's happened at long last, so some of that uncertainty has gone back. But of course, nature abhors a vacuum, and what we've seen in short order is a series of near-biblical events to do with bushfire, smoke, floods, and of course, the plague that's now upon us. So uncertainty is on the rise again. And what we're also seeing is the usual competition amongst economic commentators like me to see who can come up with the biggest negative story to go with that range of factors. Well, here's my contribution to the debate, and firstly, the bushfires. Well, what you can do is we can actually map the economic data onto those areas that have been tragically hit by those bushfires. And you can just see some high-level data on this particular chart here. So there's the regions that have been hit on the bottom of the chart. And it shows you just how important those regions are in terms of the economy and the labour market as well. So overall, what it's telling you is that those bushfire-affected regions, they account for about 3.5% of Australian GDP, and they account for about 3.75% of Australian employment. So the rough rule of thumb here, you know, there's a 10% drop in activity in those areas, it's going to knock 0.3 percentage points off GDP growth. Now, that's a significant number. It will be spread over time, but no, certainly there's some real negatives there that will be apparent in the economic data, we think. But what the analysis tends to ignore, and this is the, sort of the standard forecasting rule, and it's the standard rule because it's right, is that whatever you lose on the way down, you tend to regain during the rebuild. So yes, short-term negative, but then it'll become a slightly longer-term positive for those regions as we run through. And if you look at the structure of those particular regions, they're built in a way that actually I think will help a little bit as well when you're thinking about the potential downside. And you get a flavour from that when you look at the composition of employment in those regions. And you know, again, if you run your eye down that chart, what you'll see is around about one-third of employment is in what you could probably call public sector-related areas. Well, these people will certainly keep their jobs. They're probably going to be busier than ever during the rebuild effort. Another 10% or so are actually involved in construction in these regions, and clearly there's going to be plenty of work for them as well. It's when you come down to sectors that you could say are really exposed more to the tourism and consumer spending story, and that's about 20% of the total in these regions. That's where the negatives are going to come through. But the composition will offset or limit the downside that's coming through from what has been happening, of course. And it's in that kind of tourism consumer space that I really want to focus at the moment, because that's the kind of common linkage into the coronavirus story, which I now note the World Health Organization have come up with a name for it, and it's now public enemy number one. So bear that in mind. And the way these sort of events impact onto the economy, again, is by lifting uncertainty. Certainly that's clearly what we're seeing again. And that uncertainty then feeds down that same spending set of channels that I talked about earlier on. So trying to get a read on just how this uncertainty story is playing out will be very important in assessing the damage. And you know, again, we can revert to tools like Google to try and get a real-time read on what's going on here. So the chart on the left, it shows you Google search activity for the various epidemics and so on that we've seen in recent years. And you can see the very large run up there, the red line, the current episode. But tracking that and a turning point in that, I think it'd be pretty significant indication of just how far the economic story goes on the back of all of this. If it goes on for a long time, then obviously the effect just gets bigger and bigger. If it's a short, sharp shock, then we can survive that. What we're also seeing at the moment, of course, is that the kind of social media aspect of the story is potentially magnifying the negatives, I think, and that's not really something that was around at the time of these previous epidemics. And again, the World Health Organization is now talking about something called an infodemic. And what that is just the huge amount of information, a lot of it contradictory, a lot of it wrong, that's now out there that is just whipping up the negative sentiment part of this story. And that's as big a risk as anything else, I think. I'd also note that the technology can help us here, and I was very impressed to read that one of those unlucky people stuck on that cruise liner off Japan at the moment managed to order a case of wine and get it delivered by drone. So the technology is there. Now, the kind of transmission channel into Australia, if you like, is through tourism and education. And so in the interest of time, I'm just going to talk about the tourism part of the story, because as I say, it ties in with the bushfire impact and the like. And the chart on the right-hand side just gives you a snapshot of tourism. Well, it's a bit more than 3% of Australian GDP, and nearly 4% of people are actually involved, or sorry, nearly 5% of people are involved in, or jobs in the tourism-related parts of the economy. The focus you see in the debate, once again, is just on the negative side of the story here, and that is about less foreign tourists coming to Australia and the economic cost that's going to bring with it. And certainly, you will see that in the tourist arrival numbers. These numbers do respond to economic shocks. They do respond to events like we're seeing right now. In fact, the chart on the left-hand side shows you what happened to tourists coming to Australia during various other shocks. The red line, I guess the SARS line, they're the closest comparison we have to what's happening right now. So yes, there will be a negative there. But what that analysis ignores, of course, is there are a lot of Australians who actually go overseas to holiday as well. And in fact, there are far more Australian tourists going overseas than foreign tourists coming to Australia. And that appetite for the foreign holiday is also going to respond to these shocks. And the chart on the right-hand side looks at Australian departures for holiday reasons. And again, you can see the impact of economic shocks and things like SARS on the numbers there. Now, these people who may decide that they're not going on a foreign holiday now aren't just going to sit at home. There's a very good chance they'll go on a domestic holiday instead. And that redirection of spending, if you like, from overseas into Australia is going to be a very powerful offset, potentially, to the downside of those fewer foreign tourists coming to Australia. And potentially, you can construct a scenario here where that basically offsets whatever we lose on that side of the equation. So I don't want to say it's not going to have any impact at all, but you do need to think about both sides of the story here. Now, as I suggested, this tourism story, it does play out in the consumer space, and the Australian consumer has been the biggest risk to the economic outlook for a number of years now. And the chart here just gives you the big picture. So the brown line there, consumer spending growth, you can see the slowdown. It's running at the slowest rate that we've seen since the global financial crisis. It's being accentuated at the moment by the fact there's a big downturn in residential construction underway after the biggest boom that we've ever had, which is the green line on that particular chart. Now, of course, we've got these bushfires and the coronavirus amplifying the potential downside. And this story is one of the reasons why, of course, interest rates have been cut, why we've been given tax rebates and the like to try and stimulate and offset those downside risks. So how is this consumer constraint story playing out right now? Well, we can see, I think, some very interesting bits of the story here in a range of new indicators that the Commonwealth Bank constructs. We've spent years looking at our internal data. What is it telling us about the state of play in the economy? We've now made it more forward-looking by including search activity. So before anybody does anything these days, the first thing you do is jump online and check prices and product reviews and whatever. So we can combine our transactions data with that search activity. We think we've got pretty powerful tools to understand what's happening in the economy right now. And I've just picked out a couple of them on the charts you can see here. So the chart on the left, the blue line, it's kind of a measure of overall household spending intentions. It's picked up a little bit, as you can see on the end of the chart there, but it's a pretty limp result overall. And certainly a disappointing result when you consider the size of those interest rate cuts and the tax rebates that have been paid. Kind of suggests that policy is not working the way it normally does. The one exception there, of course, is the housing market. And the chart on the right-hand side, the pink line there, shows you our measure of home buying intentions. It's rocketed up. It's running at pretty much the highest level that we've seen over the life of the data that we have here. And it's proved to be a pretty good leading indicator of where house prices go. And certainly indications there that there's more to come on that that front. And that's important because as house prices go up, potentially what we're going to see is a positive wealth effect. You know, as we feel wealthier, as we are wealthier, then we tend to spend more money. And that's obviously going to help this consumer story, even if rate cuts and tax rebates and so on aren't. And we're starting to see some of that, we think, again. So the chart here, the blue line, it's a measure of vehicle buying intentions from our suite of indicators here. It's finally started to pick up, and it started to pick up pretty much in line with what's happening with house prices, the brown line on that particular chart. And that's important because we know from the research the most sensitive form of consumer spending to wealth is motor vehicles, so it seems to be happening. The chart on the right-hand side, though, is not quite so encouraging. It shows you what's happening with education spending intentions and also travel spending intentions as well. And you can see right at the end there, it has been a little bit of a drop back in those indicators. We may be seeing, you know, the early signs of an impact in those areas from all those negative things that are happening right now, but certainly an indicator we'll be watching very, very closely. So what can policymakers do to help from here? Well, when I get asked that question, like most economists, I just resort to the three Ps. Now, there are three Ps that drive economic growth in Australia, that drive income and all the rest of it, and they are population, productivity and participation. And here's what the story looks like in those three Ps, at the moment. So labour force participation's actually picked up. It's running at a record high at the moment, so that's helping. Population growth is obviously pretty strong as well right now. The major area of disappointment and where all the risks lie here really is in our productivity performance, the purple line on that chart where we've seen a very significant slowdown. And we need to lift that productivity because it's something that in the end will lift our potential growth. It will allow real wages to rise, which in the end is going to be the only solution to this consumer weakness. And it's the sort of thing that you need to see happen as well to help deal with the ageing population that's going to increasingly drive economic outcomes in Australia from here. So how do we get productivity growth? Well, again, economists will tell you typically, firstly, we want more spending on infrastructure, and I agree infrastructure is fantastic, and it needs to be more than just building bridges and roads and things. You need to include the education, the human capital side there as well. Trouble is, there's so much of it going on at the moment, it's going to be very hard to ramp that up further. So I think rather than looking big, we probably need to look small here. And what stands out is if we look at local government infrastructure in Australia, what you find is a very large amount of it is in poor condition or it's not fit for purpose. And you can see the numbers on this particular chart here. So maybe the infrastructure story we need to be pursuing right now is this kind of small-scale infrastructure. It's largely in the regions and rural areas, and they clearly need some help now. I think that'd be pretty effective assistance coming through. A lot of the debate about policy more broadly is about should we use unconventional monetary policy? Well, our view is very much we should forget that and we should be focusing on conventional fiscal policy. I mean, what we know is the government's balance sheet is actually in pretty good shape right now. We should be using that balance sheet to do the things that we need to do. And if income weakness is the fundamental cause of weak consumer spending, then finding ways to impact disposable income are clearly a policy focus that we should be pursuing, we think. Now, of course, that kind of pushes up against the idea that we must have a budget surplus, and we kind of need to overcome that, I think. But even if we're hell-bent on a budget surplus, what organisations like the OECD tell you is we can actually change the mix of taxing and spending in a way that doesn't change the bottom line. We can still have our surplus, but you can change that mix in a way that's going to help the productivity story. And we can get an idea of what we need to do in Australia. This chart that just looks at the sort of taxing structure of Australia, how does it compare with the typical OECD economy? What it tells you that we're overweight company tax, personal tax, we're underweight consumption taxes, if you like. So what it says, I think certainly the company tax debate needs to be reinvigorated as part of this overall more medium-term policy response. And just finally, if we want the government to use its balance sheet, because it's in good shape, well, then I think it's probably also fair to ask business to use their very good balance sheets as well. The chart on the right-hand side here just gives you a kind of a snapshot of that overall balance sheet. As I say, it's in good shape. So what we need to see is business actually come to the party and promote their own investment spending as well. Difficult in an age of uncertainty for sure. Now I'll stop there as I'm pretty certain that I've used up all of my time and I'll leave you to ponder the uncertainties about that, but I will just quickly fast forward through our disclaimer, which the eagle eye amongst you might notice is actually a page longer than it was last year. Thank you very much. Thank you.